And we're back. Welcome back to Frog and Progeny. Hello, Progeny. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good too. What's happening then? We're going to do a questions episode. Is that right?
We are. Yeah.
I'm completely unprepared for this, Tallulah, I'm afraid. Sorry.
Yeah, you've done no prep, but that's okay.
That's your job. That's what I pay you for.
Swing it.
Yeah. Let's go then.
Okay, so first of all, we're going to start. This probably is going to be questions that were asked quite a while ago, so apologise for that, everyone, but at least we're getting around to it. So the first question is from Kevin Hoare. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. When Fish announced his farewell retirement tour, there was talk of one last hurrah on stage with the original Marillion members at one of his final gigs. Was this ever discussed, or was it just wishful fan thinking?
I'm going to have to say it was wishful thinking. Nobody ever said anything to us about it. I don't know if we've talked about this, but I remember when he played in Aylesbury, I got word that he was pissed off that we didn't come, but I never got an invite, so it's kind of, I don't know.
You did mention that. That was a while ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, so, there was no talk about it, and to be honest, I don't think it's something we would have wanted to do, even if he had asked us at that stage. And we did do something years ago in the Market Square of Aylesbury. He was playing a gig there, and we got up and played Market Square Heroes with him, rather appropriately. Lucy's favourite song. Now I know that. I think we're past that stage. So unfortunately for all those people hoping that one day we'll have a reunion with Fish, it's even more unlikely to happen now that he's completely retired.
But never say never.
I don't ever say ever or never.
Ash Cooper, will you still tour if Marillion call it a day?
That is a good question, and I have to say I've given it no thought because I don't feel like we're at the stage of calling it a day yet.
Are you the youngest one?
Yes. At the ripe old age of 65, I'm the youngest. I think it's entirely possible that if literally it happened in the next year or two, for whatever reason, that we had to stop, that I would want to do something. It would be nice to think that I would do some sort of live performances now and again. But yeah, it's kind of not really worth speculating about or wasting time thinking about, because at the moment we've got the next couple of years planned out, and we're not thinking of stopping anytime soon, thankfully, because I quite like it.
This is from Nicholas Evans. Pompeii makes me wonder what steps you all take to cope with onstage heat, humidity. What's the worst conditions you've played in? I think you may have had a similar question to this before.
Yeah. One that always springs to mind. Well, two, actually. And they were both in the United States. One was when we were playing in this car park and all the keyboards started melting in because there was no cover from the sun. But the one that... I'm trying to think where it was. I think it was in... It was sometime in probably the 80s or early 90s. We were playing a club in the middle of summer. We used to tour in the summer in the States quite a lot for some reason. And it was so hot. I mean, we were literally drenched with sweat, you know, like you could hardly breathe because it was so hot. But I always feel sorry for the people in the audience in those situations because, you know, at least we've got a cold drink to hand and we've got some space around us. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you're not kind of crammed in with people. So, but that's what I, you know, whenever it's really unbearable on stage, I always think it must be twice as bad being in the audience. I quite like it in a funny sort of way, the being quite hot on stage, you know, and it all being a bit hot and sweaty, you sort of feel like you're, you know, it's rock and roll, you know.
Yeah, I know. I think I know what you mean.
Rather than freezing cold, which also happens.
Yeah. Okay, that's what happens when you're freezing cold, because presumably that's...
Well, age gets really upset about it, because sometimes you'll have like air conditioning units blasting cold air on the stage. Right. One minute he's running around getting sweaty and hot, and then he might sit down at the piano and have to play a song, and his clothes are wet and the freezing cold air is blowing on him, and he's like, oh, I'm going to catch a death of cold here. So he's kind of a very vocal and understandably quite against air conditioning blasting the stage.
Right. I
remember...
Even if it's boiling?
Not if it's boiling, I suppose, but if it's just like normal, you know, they tend to crank up, especially in the States, they tend to crank up the AC all the time anyway. The first cruise we did, I remember there was this guy, the stage manager, he had a problem with his voice. He talked like that, you know. Rich said to him, he said, "So, just so as you know, H doesn't want to have this air conditioning blasting out while we're on stage." And he said, "Tell your singer to get his big boy pants on and do the gig." I was like, okay.
And what did H do? Did he just do it?
No, I think Rich persuaded him that it wasn't about putting his big boy pants on, and that he really needed to have the air conditioning not on.
Yeah, that's a bit diva-y. Some people would see that as diva-y.
Well, I think that's what the guy thought. He thought he was being a bit of a diva, you know, like, stop being a baby, just do the gig, you know.
Does anyone have any really diva-y requests that you can remember?
What, you mean like bowls of M&Ms with no brown ones? That's
anything like that.
Not really. I mean, that story about, I think it was Van Halen requested that they had, you know, a bowl of M&Ms with no brown ones. They said the reason they did that wasn't to be diva-ish, it was because it was a way of checking that the venue had read the rider, because if there was no M&Ms, they obviously hadn't read the rider properly, you know. So,
or they'd gone, not doing that.
Yeah, that's possible, yeah. So anyway, no, I don't think there's any diva-ish behaviour in the band.
I'm going to stop asking my questions and get on to other people. Catherine Roik, just discovered your Marathon album and read somewhere that you musically channeled what Marillion wouldn't use or let you use with Marillion. I absolutely love this album, and I'm particularly fond of Amelia and Puppets. Can't imagine Marillion would not want this. Capitals? ?
Well, to be fair to the band, the Puppets song was kind of written separate from anything that I was doing with Marillion. What I did was I took some of the jams that we'd done as a band, where I was leading the jam, in the sense that it was a, you know, like a keyboard led idea that never got used. And, you know, if they've been around, I mean, it happens that we've had stuff that's around for 5 or 10 years sometimes. In fact, there's something on the new album that we're working on now, which is from 2010, believe it or not. We've finally found a home for it. We all loved it. Wow. And we, you know, we kind of went, oh, this will be great for this song. But there are times when we do stuff and you can just kind of tell that some things are just not going to get used, you know, for whatever reason. And sometimes I took stuff that may well have got used, you know, and I said to Mike, our producer, by the way, I've used this on my solo album, so don't suggest it to the band.
Has it ever been a problem? Like, has anyone in the band ever gone, oh, what? You used that? I was hoping we'd use that here.
Not really. I mean, there was something that Steve Rothery did. He did a song with a John Helmer lyric called Night Water, I believe, which he put on his first solo album. And the music was from one of the Marillion songs, which I can't remember which one it was now. Bell in the Sea, I think. So the same piece of music got used twice. And I'm not sure how that happened. Maybe I think he'd written the song and then we did something with the music. Anyway, so it's not necessarily a barrier to using something that's already been used in one way, because it'll probably end up being quite different, you know. Mm. There's a thing, actually, that we were doing the other day, working on one of the songs, and the part I'm playing, as we were listening back, I'm like, oh, God, that sounds like a bit from the Marathon album that I did. I didn't say anything, because by the time we get to the finished song, it might not be anything like it. So it kind of happens, but not very often. I've not had any complaints from anybody saying, oh, I wish you hadn't used that piece of music because it would have been great on the next Marillion album, you know. We've got so many musical ideas that I don't see it being a problem, really. But you're right, Catherine, I don't understand why they haven't used more of my ideas. Shocking.
This is from Kevin Tattersall. Mark, may I ask how many albums do you think the band has in them before the creativity is gone? And would you make an album with another producer?
I think the answer to the second question is, I think we would make an album with another producer. I'm not saying we're planning to, but it could happen. And as far as creativity goes, we've got so many, as I keep saying, we've got so many ideas we've not used, that I think even if we stopped coming up with new ideas now, we could probably put together two or three more albums if we wanted to.
That's what you kind of said with Lucy, didn't you?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that we're going to, because there has to be that desire to do it. And one of the other things, of course, is not just the music, but the lyrics. How much more has H got to say lyrically? I kind of worried about that a few years ago. But with what he's written for
He's got nothing left to say.
Well, not that he's got nothing left to say, but it felt like he was going through a bit of a lean
writer's
period
block.
As a lyricist. But the stuff he's come up with for this album is so good. I'm really liking a lot of it. And there's more lyrics than we need. So
yeah, I feel like that's just how creativity works. Like, it ebbs and flows, you know? Like,
it does.
It's not about running out of things to say, but
as a lyricist, it probably depends on what you write about and, you know, what's going on in your life, what's going on in the world. Depends what sort of writer you are, I suppose, where you get your inspiration from.
H is quite, he does take inspiration from what's going on in the world quite a lot, doesn't he?
Yeah. And personal stuff. Musically, I'm far more inspired now than I was through the 80s and 90s. I coming up with new musical ideas now, for me, I feel a lot more prolific coming up with ideas. The thing I struggle with is arranging them into songs.
Mm.
You know, whereas I think in the earlier part of the band's career, Steve Rotherick came up with most of the musical ideas, and now it's probably me. So, you know, it's just... For now, who knows, you know.
This is from Diana Andrea. How do you feel about some people being moved to tears by Marillion's music? Have any of you experienced this with other artists' work from the position of fans?
Yes, I think it's... Personally, yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, music can move you to tears, or at least... Yeah, it does, you know, and give you goosebumps and, you know, make you feel really emotional. And that's great. I mean, I love that. I mean, it's rare that I get it. I don't get moved to tears from our music. There's been a couple of times when we've been playing on stage and I've kind of been so distracted by being into the song as a listener that I messed up what I was playing. So, you know,
this is good.
Yeah, it kind of, well, or just really feeling it and, you know, and just being, you know, distracted from what I'm supposed to be doing, which is playing. So it does happen. Or, you know, you get goosebumps. There's a few things that there's a song that we were working on right now, maybe because I know the story behind it, but when I listen to it, it gives me shivers, gives me goosebumps, you know. So I think that's a good sign, you know. I love it when I get that from music, you know.
Are there any musicians who've done that to you?
Yes. Now you're going to ask me to name one, but off the top of my head, I'm struggling to think. So I have to come back to that.
Surely, like, one of your favourite bands?
Maybe some of Elbow's stuff is a bit like that for me.
I was just thinking Elbow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
Elbow is very... Is it that thing where music kind of... euphoric? Is that the right word?
Yeah, you can see.
Elbow's quite... Their arrangements are very, like, all-encompassing.
They can be very emotional and uplifting sometimes as well.
Yeah.
Or just, you know, poignant.
I think lyrically as well, Guy Garvey is very... He's a really good lyricist.
Yeah, I hadn't realised that album, The Seldom Seen Kid, is about a friend of theirs that died. But that's where a lot of the emotion in music and lyrics comes from, isn't it? From experiences that people who wrote those songs had. And if you know something about the story behind it, it can make it even more, you know, poignant for you.
Mm. Gavin McIntosh. Hi, with so many sounds now available, how on earth do you even start to choose what you want to use in a song?
You know what? It is a kind of the tyranny of choice, I think they call it, don't they?
Yeah.
There is so much. I mean, I've got so many instruments, you know, virtual instruments that I've got access to. I sometimes forget that I've got some, and I suddenly go, oh, yeah, I've got that one. I'll check that out. But I do spend quite a bit of time literally going through sounds and kind of ranking them in, you know, the ones that I really like. And, you know, I give them like 1 to 5 stars or whatever. But that only works up to a point, because sometimes the things that are that you didn't like in a...
Depend on your mood as well.
Exactly, yeah, but also depends on the music. So in a particular piece of music, something that you thought was not actually that useful is perfect, you know. So, that's really how it... Well, there's 2 things. One, I try to save the things that I really like the sound of. And 2, when we're jamming, I try to get myself like a palette of sounds ready, of things that I think would work. And sometimes the sound is the inspiration for the part, for the music that you're writing. So they kind of go together. So if that happens, like there's a few things on this album where it's literally the sound and the part I'm playing is the thing. And then that became the sort of the idea that we then worked on to develop into a song. So they kind of go hand in hand. And I sometimes could try, very occasionally, I'll go back to previous albums and sounds that I've used in the past, because it's like guitarists, they'll come up with a great guitar sound and they'll use it multiple times on multiple songs. I'll spend hours working on a sound and use it once in one song.
Yeah.
And I think it's crazy, you know.
Do you ever get like quite wrapped up and frustrated? Like it could drive you quite crazy if you're like listening to all these sounds that you had and then you use one and you develop it and then you listen to another one and you think, oh, it would have been better with that. Do you ever do that?
Yeah, or I just keep looking and looking and looking.
Yeah,
trying things, and I'm like thinking, oh, this
perfectionist.
Is this piano sound, for example, I'm working on. I spent like 2 days just trying to get the perfect piano sound, and it's not like I don't mean perfect in the sense that sounds most real. I mean perfect as in the sound that works best with this song, and it's kind of artificial sounding. But I did went through so many different attempts, you know, and then you kind of end up, half the time you end up coming back to the thing that you use first.
yeah,
especially if it's something that you wrote a piece of music with, you know, it's always like the first thing you come up with musically and the first sound that you work with can be the best, you know.
This is from Ron Graves. Not sure what the question is. Maybe if you could talk about how much you really know about the other fellas and how much time you really talked to each other outside of work?
It's a good question. As far as how much we know about each other, an awful lot, because we've been together for 40 years, more than 40 years, some of us. But also, we don't spend a lot of time talking about personal stuff, if I'm honest, when we're together.
What do you talk about?
A lot of inappropriate joking goes on, you know.
Like what? Politically
incorrect stuff, which gets... Mike's got a camera set up in the studio running the whole time, one of these sort of 360 camera things, so that we can capture some video footage.
Yeah.
You know, so we can capture some video footage of creative moments as they happen. But of course it captures everything. And we often joke about if this stuff ever got out, we'd be
cancelled.
We'd be cancelled. We'd be ruined. So
who's the worst?
Who's the worst? Oh, that's a good question. That would be telling. I'd say the least worst is Steve Rothery.
Right.
I'll just leave it at that.
I think you're probably the worst.
Oh, come on. I'd say me, H and Mike are probably leading the charge on saying things that probably shouldn't be said.
Daryl Box.
I've got my pet dog.
Same. I'm not using it today.
Mine's a puppy. Yours is bigger than mine.
Hi, Daryl. Hi, Mark and T. I have a question for your podcast. If all the band members walked into a music shop, would you be able to pick up your representative instruments and play any Marillion song straight off without any programming or effects?
We could certainly have a go. It would sound a bit like Bill Bailey doing his impersonation of The Edge. I don't know if anybody's seen that video. He's got no effects on his guitar. Because, you know, U2, it's all ding, 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 lots of echo and stuff. Without it, it just sounds like dink, dink, dink. but yeah, I think certainly Pete is the most capable musician in the band. Not only could he pick up his own instrument, he could probably pick up practically any instrument and get a tune out of it.
Really?
Yeah, he's very musical, Pete. But yeah, I think we could have a fair stab at most of them.
Can he do that thing where you play him a song and he'll play it?
Pretty much, yeah, yeah. Or you could play him a few chords and he'll tell you what they are, you know. He hasn't got perfect pitch, but he's got a very good ear for you know, musical intonation between notes and chords and stuff. H is very good at that too. I always ask Pete whenever I've got whenever I'm trying to remember how something goes that I've written that I can't remember. Hey, what's that chord there? And you're listening and go, oh, that's a G major 7 or whatever, you know.
Wow. Like,
okay. Yeah. So.
Did he have music lessons as a child?
No.
Did any of you?
Ian. Yeah, he's the only one that could kind of read music, really. The rest of us have got no clue.
Mark Donald. Mark, have you any plans for another marathon project? Love the first album, would love to see another.
Me too. Can somebody help me write it? No. I have been working on it here and there, bits and pieces, but it's not in any state to be called an album yet. I think I need another lockdown or something to stop Marillion working for a year. Then I could do it. I think it's in my plans.
Andy Williams, bit of a random question. I've often heard that various band members, including Fish, mentioned Pete's garage, suggesting it was once the band's unofficial pre-record nerve centre where songs were developed, plots were hatched, and crisis meetings held. Could you tell us more about this location and the key moments it hosted?
So you make it sound far more glamorous than it really was.
Pete's garage?
Just Pete's garage, yeah. Make it sound like some mastermind, secret lair, yeah. Or some club, you know. No, literally, Pete had a house on the outskirts of Aylesbury, surrounded by fields, and he had just a double garage. It was just an ordinary house. And because he had a big garage and he was in the middle of nowhere, effectively, there was no neighbours to disturb, we ended up using that because we didn't have anywhere else. That was literally it. But it wasn't in any way glamorous. It was barely big enough to fit us all in. Mm. And yeah, I can remember that summer, the summer that Fish left, when we worked there, we'd have the garage doors open. You know, there were kind of those up and over doors, I think. And just open to the outside world. And we would just rehearse and try to write songs. But no, it wasn't really like Bracket One or anything like that. And because we'd gone from working in a place called Gnomis in London, which was a proper rehearsal complex, really, a big building in Shepherd's Bush area. But it was so expensive. I think we were trying to cut costs a little bit, I think.
Any memories that it hosted?
Well, the main memory from Pete's garage, because we I think we started working in Pete's garage in that summer, and then Fish left, and then come January we were auditioning people, and we auditioned Steve Hogarth there.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. So And he sang the very first version of The King of Sunset Town, which got him the gig.
Cool. Yeah. Catherine Rude Elster. This year, Marillion are playing gigs in quite a few seated venues, some of which look really beautiful. But what do you personally prefer, playing a standing audience or a seated one?
Personally, it kind of doesn't make much difference to me. I know the singers, as in H and Fish before him, I think preferred a standing audience, certainly in the past, because you feel like they give more back, you know. If people are sat down, it's kind of the atmosphere or the energy level in the room is obviously going to feel lower. And, you know, if you're a front man, you want to have an audience that's up for it, you know, and jumping around a bit and being more active. So I can see why. But it doesn't make any difference to me. And I would say generally seated venues tend to be nicer. So I think that's a plus. Yeah.
Do you feel as appreciated?
Yeah, I mean, nicer as in nicer buildings, nicer in,
oh,
in
right, nicer,
in nothing to do with the music, but usually in a nicer part of town. You know, the standing venues tend to be big warehouses on the outskirts of town with no facilities and sticky floors and
and
horrible toilets. You know, so from a purely selfish
point, they don't separate the M&Ms there.
No, I like a nice theatre or a symphony hall rather than a club with...
Snob.
Am I a snob?
And this is another follow-up from Catherine. And do you have a preferred crowd size? Is it the more the merrier, or do you enjoy smaller, more intimate venues?
I like it, yeah. I like unusual venues, I have to say. There was one that springs to mind was when we played in Belfast. It was like almost like a big pub, and the stage was so small and such a weird shape that I was like down the front on the side, and it was kind of good being close to the audience, you know. And they were kind of really close to the stage because it was small. So those sort of things. And I used to love playing at the Marquee as well, which was another small venue. So it's fun when you can see people really close.
Another one from Gavin McIntosh. Is there any super new pieces of tech you would love to incorporate into your sound, but it's just too expensive right now?
Well, if I had to choose something that was too expensive right now that I'd like to have a play with, would be one of those, it's like a racking system, which is basically a big modular synthesizer. You know, you have this thing called a Eurorack, which is lots of different companies make modules for it, and you can build your own synth basically with lots of different parts, and it can be as big as you like, you know, with all, and you use cables to patch it all together, and it's hideously expensive if you want to buy a decent amount of gear.
How much?
Well, each of the modules can be anything from £100 to £1,000 each, you know, and then you might have 20 or 30 of those, you know, so it can be it's not cheap. It's not a cheap hobby.
Paul Gilhooley. I just pre-ordered .com reissue deluxe edition. I know you're working through the albums and your prog and progeny conversations, but why skip Radiation in the deluxe editions, or did I miss it?
We skipped it because Mike Hunter did a remix of it in 2013, I believe. So it's kind of had a bit of a revamp already, so we figured people aren't going to want to buy it again if we've already done a remixed version of it. I think it was 5.1 as well, I'm not sure. But that was why it was skipped. Maybe it's something we can do at some point. So when we finished all the others.
Ronald Scrimgeour, what TV programmes have you been watching lately, or films?
TV programmes lately? Well, of course, everybody watched Pluribus.
I did a little reference to that not long ago.
Yeah. Hello, Karen. Is it Karen? Hello,
Carol.
Carol, yeah.
I'm actually watching Better Call Saul. I know I'm late to it, but that I've watched Breaking Bad and now I'm watching Better Call Saul.
I watched all of those years ago, but you were definitely late for that one. That's a good question. I'm trying to think of... I haven't been watching TV recently because I haven't found anything worth watching.
Have you seen the new Game of Thrones spin-off thing? It's called A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. It's really funny. It's really good. You'd like
funny.
It. It's only six episodes. Yeah, they've made it like kind of crass. It's like a crass comedy.
Karina and I decided, because we couldn't think of anything to watch, we'd go through the IMDb database top 250 films and literally start at the top. And when we came across a movie that neither of us had seen, we'd watch it. So the first one we got was Citizen Kane, which is a bit of an old movie. I suppose, taken in context, it's like you can see why it was considered a great movie at the time, but that was like 1941, I think, when it came out. So the fact that it's still kind of watchable now shows how good it was for the time, because it's fucking old.
This is from Nicholas Evans. How long does it take you guys to be able to perform a song?
What does he mean? What, in terms of rehearsal?
How many days do you need? How much together rehearsal? Like, say you were going to suddenly do Cinderella Search. He's given us an example.
It's a bit of a movable feast, because when you say perform a song, do you mean perform a song really well or just get through it? Because if you wanted to just get through it, one run through and we'd be able to get through it, you know. That's usually what happens in rehearsal. If the song we haven't played for a year, 10 years, whatever, a year maybe not, but, you know, 10 years, 15 years, whatever, and there's quite a few, you'd be surprised, even from the H catalogue, there's a lot of songs that, you know, 10 years goes by and then we go, oh, let's do that. And we're like, oh, how does that go? But literally one run through and we've pretty much sorted out most of it. It's kind of comes back, you know. And then after that, we're just playing it to improve it really and just get it as good as, you know, so it's something we could present to an audience. But if we had to, yeah, give us an hour with a song and it would be of a sufficient standard that we wouldn't be too embarrassed to play it in front of an audience.
Do you rehearse the songs that you're going to play first more?
What do you mean? The songs for early in the set list? That's a good question. No, we tend to try and tackle the songs that we think are going to be the worst. Mm. So, you know, if we've got a set list that includes Easter and Beautiful, and you know, those sorts of songs, we'd be like, okay, we don't need to play those. We know those. We'd concentrate on the ones that we've not played for a very long time or that are particularly difficult. And then towards the end of the rehearsal, maybe on the last day, we'll run through Easter and Beautiful and things like that we kind of feel like we know. And that can sometimes be a mistake, because it will be, that's the song that'll catch you out. Like on the cruise, I don't think we rehearsed Kaylee once for the cruise. And Rothers, for the first time in his entire life, completely screwed up the solo in it, which was just like a mic drop moment, you know.
Oh dear.
He said, "I thought he broke a string," and he just hadn't played it, and he just had a moment, you know. So
yeah.
It happens. I did feel for him because, you know, when H messes, it's funny when H messes up, he just laughs about it, and that's fine. When I mess up, Rothers looks at me like he can smell something bad. He's sort of like this.
So did you do that to him?
He leaves the audience in no doubt that it's me. By looking over.
You may as well point and stop playing.
Yeah, and I get embarrassed. When Rothers messes up, everybody's just stunned because he hardly ever messes up. So.
So Nicholas has another question, and I was going to ask this too. How do you put your set lists together?
We used to argue about them a lot, and we used to have it'd be like, oh, I think we should do this. Oh, I don't want to play that. I don't want to play this. Now everybody's much more relaxed about it. Quite often, one of us, it might be H, might be me, might be Ian. Sometimes even Lucy will suggest stuff and say, here, what about these songs? In fact, I think she did that for Pompeii. She made like a list. Or H made a big list of possible contenders. And then Lucy said, oh, I was making a list and it's very similar to yours or something like that. So, but we'll kind of narrow it down. And how we actually decide in the end is more about trying to have, make sure that the set's got a good pace to it, so it's not like a bunch of really slow songs together. That's something that Ian tends to be more sensitive about. So he'll say, oh, you know, we've got like 4 ploddy songs in a row here. You know, this is like, can we do something a
that
bit
makes
more,
sense? Because he's
with a bit more energy, yeah. So that's kind of Ian's role. Usually, H might say, oh, I really, really want us to play this song. We haven't played it for ages, so we'll just fit that one in, or, you know, that sort of thing. There'll be, everybody's got their favourites and everybody's got the ones they don't really like, you know.
Does where you're playing factor in? Like, say, sometimes. Playing in Rio, would Beautiful be on the set list?
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah. In fact, we've got a song called Hope for the Future, which has got a bit of a sort of Caribbean-y, sambery kind of feel to it. And H said, oh, we should play that in South America. It'll go down really well. It's like, no, because we can't play that sort of music, really. It's like, you know,
yeah.
five white guys trying to play music with that sort of feel. Everybody was just looking at us stunned. In fact, people said, we come to see Marillion to see you play progressive rock music. We want to see that sort of music. We go and watch a lot.
I didn't
band,
mean but... like, do you change what a song's like to sound like that country's music? More just like what's popular in each country.
Yeah, yeah, that's, we definitely do that. Like play Beautiful in Brazil, for example, because it was a big hit there.
This is from Dan. Hi, Mark. Do you happen to know when your Mini Moog was manufactured? Is it of early 70s vintage?
My Mini Moog was probably, I don't know the exact date, but it was probably sometime in the late 70s, because the serial number is 11,000 and something. So I think what he's referring to, because you've got basically three periods of Mini Moog. The earliest were pretty unstable and not very playable. And then in the sort of early 70s, to mid-70s, there was kind of what they call the second generation or second revision, where they were more stable, but they didn't stay in tune really well, which is fine if you're in the studio, but on stage it wasn't very useful. The one I've got was even more stable still, and people, I have to admit, the purists tend to prefer the middle ground ones, But they're just a little bit more organic, you know, a little bit less reliable in the sound, but which adds a bit of a, you know, a human quality to them, I suppose. I'm not sure how you would describe it, but you know, it's a sound wise, it's a good instrument. That's all I'll say. So yeah, but when I bought it, it looked brand new. It doesn't look brand new anymore. It was still in the cardboard box that it came in. You know, the guy who owned it had it for a couple of years, and I think it just sat in the box under his bed, you know. Yes, it's currently... I'm selling it in this Dutch auction, reducing the price every month. It's dropped 5%. It's going to drop another 5% in about a week's time, which will take it down to about 18,000, which is... For most people, probably still too much, but eventually I'm sure it will reach a price where somebody will buy it. So keep following it. It's for sale on reverb.com. Before we go, I'll mention the podcast that we're going to do next, which will be a little mini podcast for our Patreon subscribers. And we're going to do music, new Marillion music. Tallulah's reaction to it, Tallulah's reaction to some other music that I wanted to listen to. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you soon.